From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Hello, this is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This week we're bringing you a talk that was given by Eileen Younghusband at this year's Veterans Reunion Day. It's about the vital role of the secret filter room in air defence during World War II.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see a big audience, and I hope you will enjoy the afternoon. I'm first of all going to read two little paragraphs. You all know how Mr. Churchill told how wonderful the few were. Well, since then, there is something else he said, so I will read this. The wonderful achievement of the few is a remarkable story of courage and rugged tenacity. Their achievement is worthy of the highest and most enduring recognition, which they richly deserved. But another quote of Churchill has not, unfortunately, entered the lexicon of the Royal Air Force. All the ascendancy of the Hurricanes and Spitfires would have been fruitless but for the system known as the Dowding system, instigated by Air Vice Marshal Stuffy Dowding. But it is the pivotal role of the filter room within the system which allowed commanders at all levels to manage the battle from a common picture of the air. Now, how many people here have ever heard of the filter room? Not a single one. In fact, it's almost become more secret than Bletchley. Now, somewhere else in Bletchley, you will find a plotting table. And it is an ops room plotting table, which there were many. And I'm sure all of you have heard of the radar chain, which encircled our coast. Has anyone ever thought, how did the information from the radar station turn into a little plot on the end of a stick pushed along the table by a young WAF? Well, I will tell you a little bit about it, because I had the privilege of finding myself involved in that very process. What does it have to do with Bletchley? Well, we were actually an outstation for Bletchley, without knowing it. We used to have Bletchley information fed into us for us to use for identification. But in addition, when I became an officer, there were 8 Wren officers in our officers' mess, stationed a little farther down the road at Stanmore than we were. We were a secret mess, and only people who'd signed the Official Secrets Act were there, just as the Wrens had. They never knew what we did, and we never knew what they did. And that was the story until 1980, when I went to America. I met an American who, it transpired, had worked at Bletchley here, one of the first ones sent over when the USA knew about Bletchley, and he worked with Wrens here on a bomb. But at one stage, the powers that be said all the bombs are in Bletchley. If a real bomb hit here, we'd lose them all, and they're expensive and long time to make. So they started sending them out. And one of the outstations was near Stanmore, Middlesex, near Fighter Command headquarters. And of course, there was close liaison. So that is how I'm called a Bletchley outstation veteran, just by that little link. But how did I get into the Air Force? How did I get into that job? You wouldn't think now, when you see youngsters of 19 going and people frightened about how they're going to get on going abroad at that age. I was 16 in 1938, and I was sent to teach English on an au pair basis to Alsace-Lorraine, to Contrexéville, to 3 children of a French deputy, member of the French Parliament. And it was May 38. The average public, were not thinking about war, although we knew Hitler was building up his strength. So I taught these children until August. And then the Member of Parliament that I was working for, he was one of the chasseurs as a volunteer. I suppose he was called up. And in August, he was sent to the borders of the River Rhine. And there in the so-called demilitarized zone, there was the German army and the river was mined. So he sent home straight away that I had to return home, which I did. I was then just 17 by that time. I came back, found my way from Paris onto a train, and I will never forget this. It was filled with German refugees, Jewish refugees escaping. And in that carriage, there were people with their curtains tied up around their goods, old sheets, anything. And they had fear on their faces. And as they got near to Calais to get over to Britain, you could see the fear going. So that's how I got into the war. I came home and we thought it was all going to be over, off to the letter, peace in our time. And of course, war's declared. And by the time I was 19, I decided I wouldn't just be working in an office and doing help in the evening at a canteen. I decided to enroll in the Royal Air Force. And about that time, after I volunteered, it took you a little while before you got your interview, I met a fellow scholar of mine at school, and she was in uniform as a WAF. And I said, I'm joining up. She said, good, but tell them you want to be a clerk special duty, because they're sure to say, do you want to be a cook or a driver? So I said, okay, what does that mean? I can't tell you. I've signed the Official Secrets Act. So I went to Industrial House, I was interviewed, and they said, do you want to be a cook or a driver? I said, no, I want to be a clerk special duties. The woman took off. How do you know about that? I said, I've been told to tell you I'm good at mathematics. And that was the magic word. So that's what I became. Once we were told we were going to be ops filter or radar op, even at that stage, even if we hadn't passed the training, we had to sign that Official Secrets Act. Now, if a girl came in and she wasn't suitable, they'd misread the signs. They kept her on as either an orderly or they kept her on as a telephone operator, so she wasn't allowed out of the system. And I became initially a plotter. Now, a filter room plotter was very different from an ops room plotter. So the clerk special duties covered a radar operator, it covered the ops room plotters in the ops room at the sectors, but it also covered the filter room, and they were the ones with the mathematical ability. And I was chosen to go to the filter room. I had 2 weeks training, and then I found myself in this secret underground place. They were all underground at that stage. And so what did we do? Right. First of all, radar, because of Watson Watt deciding it would be a chain system, chain home system, he had radar stations along the coast, eventually circling the whole of Great Britain. One would look in that direction with a restricted line of shoot, but one would overlap it that way, one would overlap it that way, and that's how it was, a chain overlapping all the way round. So that meant you could get perhaps three lots of information on every detected aircraft. So why was that essential? Well, if German bombers were coming in, five abreast, but there were a load behind, the station here saw five plus aircraft. The one over here saw 20 plus. One over there may have seen 50 plus. And that is how the word filter comes in. The filter plotter displayed on the table all these salient bits of information. The filterer officer looked at it instantly by crossing arcs from varying stations at the same time, got the first correct position of an aircraft. When they'd got two correct positions, they would put down an arrow, and that would give the direction. But at the same time, the radar stations had to estimate A, the numbers, and B, the height. And because radar was worked on pulse transmission and not on complete regular transmission. Instead of the area going out like a big balloon of coverage, it went out like a load of sausages. And an aircraft could hit the highest or the middle or whatever. So again, you had probably two or three bits of information. Again, this was displayed on the table. But information is no good unless it's relevant one to the other. So the time had to be the same. So a plotter would put down the position plot in their colour of their radar station, because every radar station was different colour, so we knew where the information came from. Every plot had a number 1 to 5, and they lasted for half a minute. So on the time list, when that changed from 1 to 2, the next one went up, and I would relate 1 to 1 or 2 to 2, and that's how you built up the track. So eventually, there would be probably 20-odd airwomen round a table, and eventually it was almost predominantly the airwomen, and eventually almost all the filter officers were women too, because initially they used scientists, and the scientists were too, shall I say, picky. They weren't quick enough, because they'd say, well, of course that could be so-and-so, but that was no good. You had to make instant decisions. So then they went to the stock market, and they picked men from the stock market to do this job, because profit or loss, life or death. And they were good, but there weren't enough of them. So they were then put up on a balcony and became what was called a controller. So they then had to start using the women. Originally, they were other ranks, and then they found very soon how good they were, and they were immediately commissioned. I have a friend who started in September 39, she's now 94, and she was one of the first filterers as a corporal, moved the arrows around and estimated the heights and everything. Now, how was this information displayed? It was displayed on a metal plaque, which was magnetized, and each would bear a raid number. They'd start at 100, working through to 500, and then continuous like that. So a new track would be put down, and it would be, say, number 135. Okay, I'd say to the raid orderly, 50 plus at 10,000 feet, that would be. And she would add that information. In the meantime, the people on the radar station may have got a signal saying IFF, identification friend or foe. All friendly aircraft were equipped with a device that would send a signal out every 10 seconds. And so when their radar response came back into the radar stations around the coast, it showed in the way of an echo that went up and down like this. And every 10 seconds, you'd get this extra bleep going down. And that proved it was IFF. Now, the Germans didn't have that. And the pilots were always careful that, of course, if they crashed, it automatically was demolished. And if they landed, that was the first thing they got rid of. Sometimes the pilot didn't remember to put it on. Sometimes the pilot thought the Germans could pick it up, but it couldn't because the wavelength was different. So we could get aircraft coming in without showing IFF, which were friendly. And that's where the filter room controller, the now stock market people on the balcony, where they came in. They would receive information from all the sources, the movement's liaison source, and probably teletex of any known movement of friendly aircraft. So they would know if a squadron of bombers was going out from what direction, or if fighters were being scrambled. And he would look down on the table in this cleaned-up form, irrespective of all the hundreds of plots around, and he would say, make raid 135 a fighter. So that had an F on it. Or bomber, the B on it. But if he thought it was a hostile, it was H for hostile. And from then on, the hostile raid got always first treatment by us. But in addition, there was one other thing that our fighters had. And they could change the strength of that IFF to a much stronger one. And that was if they were in danger. And it was called broad IF. Now, that took priority even over a hostile aircraft. We would move that information much more quickly. One thing that was insisted on, the people that worked on radar, we must not have any form of accent. Now, that sounds pretty awful, doesn't it? But there was a very good reason. Supposing someone with a strong Scottish accent was on a radar station, and the plotter in the filter room was from the North Country, and one or other didn't hear what the other was saying, and it had to be repeated, that half minute would have changed. She would be putting down the wrong plot at the wrong time to be coordinated with somebody else's plot with the same number on. And it was the essence of accuracy, of time, knowing where it came from. And of course, you've got to be a bit intuitive. I don't say we were always right, but don't forget, all the time as you were moving near the coast, more information came in, more accurate information came in. So we wouldn't just put on the plaque, make it a 50 plus at 10. We would say, no, make it 100 plus at 9 or 8, because they lost height. It was constant reassessment all the time. It's quite different from what you see of just one person moving one little thing. It's a frenzy. It was organized chaos. Underground, not good lighting, indifferent heating, indifferent air conditioning. 8-hour watches with a quarter of an hour break. But those girls, those filter plotters, I can never speak too highly of. They were wonderful. No one got hysterical. No one didn't do their job properly wherever I went. And the one thing about it, you have to remember these girls, their brother, their father, their cousin, their fiancé, were maybe in those bombers that they were plotting in. And we'd plot out 500 bombers. And when they came back, there were 450. And then two would wander in quietly and two would crash in the sea, or one would crash in the sea. And yet those girls never, ever let us down. I am so proud of them, and I feel that their story has to be told. And I hope you now know a little bit more about what I call the linchpin of the defence of Great Britain. Because as Churchill did say, if that hadn't happened, if the filter room had not done their job properly, our fighters would have had to be up in the air much longer. We didn't have enough. We didn't have enough petrol. We didn't have enough pilots. But it was thanks to the brilliance of Stuffy Dowding's organisation of the chain, in the same way that Watson Watt had evolved a chain. And then the V1s started. Now, the V1s we called divers. And you could always pick up a diver, because when it came in, it was at a regular height and it went on a predestined course. And when it ran out of fuel, it dropped and exploded. And we'd get the fighters up at the last minute. They would then tip the wings or shoot them down, and we had great success with that. So that was the first of the V weapon that the filter room dealt with. Then the V2 came. I do remember particularly the first V2 that landed on London, because I happened to be at Fighter Command headquarters by then. And we'd been told that there was a secret weapon. We didn't know anything about it, but some of the radar stations were fitted with some equipment that might give a clue. And if any radar plotter gave a message to the filter room plotter that said the code word Big Ben, the first filterer had to get on a chair and shout out Big Ben 3 times. Guess who was the one who did the first one? On September the 8th, that was me. The V2 was supersonic. So radar, in a way, wasn't much use for that. It couldn't do anything to get any interception. But it was good in one way. Because of it was a supersonic curve, it went up like that, and then on the top, it slowed down before it came back to Earth. And there was a new radar then invented, which picked up the very top of that curve. And that, initially in England, around the London area, gave warning. But Churchill decided not to use it, because by the time you'd got that information, it would already have exploded on the ground, because it took just about 3 minutes, 50 seconds from launch. These were all initially being launched from the Pas-de-Calais area, from ramps. And That information was used in a different way because we then managed to extrapolate the curve back to where they were launched from purely by geometry, trigonometry, using a slide rule. And we would find where it was launched from, and then later on, fighter bombers or bombers would go and destroy the launch site. After November 1944, Germany was in retreat. They'd left France. They were moving back. So they were still launching V2s on Britain. But as the distance went, it was more on the north part of London, Norfolk area, Suffolk area, but also on a very, very important place, Antwerp. Antwerp had V2s land on it, 200 or 300 more than ever landed on London in a much smaller space. And I can see you saying, why Antwerp? Why was it so important? Antwerp was the first clean port we ever had because the Germans left it before they could destroy anything. They put mines in the river, but nothing more. And so they realized that we were then able to take our troops through, our supplies through, much more swiftly than we'd ever been able to do before because they were all being flown in. And so they started bombarding it. So 8 of us were sent over to 2nd Tactical Air Force at a town called Malines, Mechelen, 15 miles from Brussels and 10 miles from Antwerp. And we did exactly the same as they were doing in London, but they were launching it from lorries then. And it took them 25 minutes from the time it was launched to the time they could move that lorry away. The lorries were always moved away from their bases into the beaches or the woods or the middle of a town in a car park. And so there was that time of 25 minutes. We would get the information from mobile radar stations when it had dropped, which took, say, the 4 minutes. Then it took a minute for us to get the information. We then had 5 minutes to extrapolate that curve using the primitive slide rule. That information went to the intelligence section, who then notified patrolling mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes then bombed those launch lorries. They had about 8 to 10 minutes to get there and to find the site. And eventually we killed all the lorries by early March of 1945. And that was the end of the V2. So that is why I always feel a little bit upset that the filter room has never been ever mentioned. As I say, it's almost more secret than Bletchley. But fortunately, Fighter Command headquarters at Bentley Priory, Stanmore, is going to be opened as a museum. So it's the transfer next week of the lease to this museum. And we have built a window in memory of all the girls, all the WAF and the WAF officers who worked in the filter room. Since I wrote the book, I've had people writing to me, and it's their mother or their grandmother or their aunt. And we've now got 24, a few optional plotters, 3 filter room plotters, 5 or 6 filterer officers for next Saturday, and it's going to be unveiled. So think of us all up there trying to remedy something that should have been known some long time ago. Well, that's a very quick resume of how my life has been affected. But I've called the talk The Vital Role of the Secret Filter Room in the Air Defence of World War II. And if you think about it, it was the linchpin of that defence because it gave the warning of enemy aircraft. So that went to the ops rooms, and the ops rooms then told the sectors to scramble the fighters. But it went also to the observer corps because radar initially did not work over land because of church towers, metal, sent up permanent echoes, and the aircraft would be lost in those echoes. So they took over from the coast. It went also to air sea rescue run by the Air Force. They would send out these high-speed launches and pick up the crews very, very quickly. I mean, that was something which saved many, many lives. It also went to the guns on the coast and told them where their guns were to point in what direction for approaching aircraft. And the fifth and vital thing, it gave air raid warnings to the civilian population. As I say, we weren't Bletchley. We relied on Bletchley for extra help, for identification. We worked with Bletchley without knowing it. And as I say, it was a revelation to me about the Enigma Code. But now I find my own cousin worked here as an army officer, and he was a teacher of German. So he used to do the translation. When the code was broken, he'd translate the German into English. But in addition, he was also a special student of the Nordic gods. And it seems that when Hitler sent messages out himself, specifically to any of his commanders and people that he was in communication with, they had a code word. And their code word was always the name of one of the gods. So if it was the equivalent of Mars, it would be the military leader. If it was the god of air, it would be Goering. And if it was the equivalent of Mercury, well, you can guess who that was, Goebbels. So that is the link between Bletchley and the filter room. But you have to realise this thing of being a chain, whether it was a radar station, whether it was the way we used radar, or the way Bletchley was used as a chain to all the other things that it managed to happen. And I was talking to someone recently, and he said, you know, what is the difference between the German attitude and ours? And I said, I don't know, except I think the Germans are so methodical, but they didn't perhaps have that quirky British characteristic of thinking outside the box. I hope you feel that you know a little bit more about it.
You can find out more about Eileen and her two autobiographies by going to her website, which is at www.eyounghusband.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll have another Bletchley Park podcast extra next week. But in the meantime, why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @BPartPodcast, or join the Bletchley Park podcast Facebook group. Once again, we must thank all the speakers involved in these recordings, and of course, Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.